Hello, everybody. It's Irene here. Irene Lyon. Good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're listening to this. Just wanting to get a thumbs up from Laura, who's on the line. Just let me know that you can hear me. Super. All right. So welcome today, and thanks for those of you live and those of you who are listening to this after the fact. Glad that you're here, and just sort of feeling that end point of the course. We still have 2 weeks to go, and I'm sure that many of you are realizing how much content and how much practice there is, and to let everyone know that wherever you are at is exactly where you're supposed to be, and that this work takes time, it takes practice, it takes patience and some commitment, which is a big reason why we're offering this to you again and again so that you can go through this. So what I'm going to do is I had only one question come in from somebody that I will answer in a moment. And I'm hoping that there are some questions from all of you on the other line to ask me. And I am going to share a little bit of stuff about the last lab and a personal story of mine around breathing, sort of go into the context of the last, not the catch-up week, but the week before that. And we'll go from there and we'll see where we go. So let's just start out with a little tiny mini awareness lesson, shall we? So to do that, just find somewhere comfortable to sit, to stand. Do whatever it is you need to do to get comfy. And in the light of the first lab, follow your impulse. So feel what it is that you need to do. Do you need to walk around a little bit? Do you need to do some jumping jacks? Do you need to lie down? Do you feel like lounging on your couch? Or if you're somewhere that you can walk outside with your computer, with headphones, is that what you want to do? So maybe ask yourself that question. And this is just an audio. It's got a question. It's just an audio. And the reason is the camera ends up being time delayed. So follow the impulse to do whatever you feel you want to do. Maybe you need to go grab a glass of water or lie on your front on the ground or on your side or wiggle a little bit. And just start to notice your breath, and there were two audio lessons from lab two that had to do with breathing. One was on the exhale, focusing on the exhale, and one was focusing on the inhale. So just listening to your breath and noticing what it does naturally. And if it feels full or if it feels a little held, notice what is it that you notice about your breath. Can you feel the air expanding different parts of your chest? And breath is one of those interesting autonomic nervous system functions because it's involuntary and it's voluntary, meaning it happens, you don't have to think about it, but you also can think about it and change it. Varying ways to work with the breath to help enhance it and improve it. But really, at the end of the day, the ultimate goal of breathing is for it to suit the current situation that you're in and for it to change and modify and be resilient. And when it might need to get held for some reason, but when it doesn't need to be held anymore, it goes back to where it needs to be. And just start to bring attention to your chest area. So your sternum area, the space between the chest, the nipples, the breast tissue. Both guys and girls have breast tissue, just varying sizes. So just sense that area and maybe even bring your fingers to that area. So depending on how you're sitting or lying, you'll need to position yourself so that you can tune into that chest area with your fingers and just start to gently touch. And even as I touch that part of my body, as I slow it down, I'm kind of giving little tiny, it's not to dig in and to try to massage it. It's just to gently make some contact, maybe a little bit of a pressure, little circles even. Little circles. Can you feel the sternum bone, that chest bone? And even as I do this right now, while I'm talking to you, I'm sensing I'm waking up a little bit. I'm kind of tuning in a little bit more to this place. I can hear my voice is starting to resonate a little differently. I'm allowing my inhale to slow down a little bit. And if one hand up there is a bit too strenuous, have one hand be there. And just gently walking your fingers a little outwards, maybe towards the shoulders. Just really gentle, like mini circles. Very mini circles. Nothing, it's not brain science. There's no right or wrong way to do this. The only thing I would suggest is that you do it with ease and care. If you are holding a newborn baby and just giving it a little gentle massage on its back or on its belly or arms, it'd be like that. Or one of your, if you have a cat, a furry cat, and you're just giving a little rub like that. So treat yourself as you would want to treat someone else that you really care about. Isn't that an interesting concept? So treat yourself with utmost care. Often when we have a sore shoulder or hip or something, I've seen clients do this, we'll hit that area and say, oh, stupid hip, stupid shoulder, stupid neck. So awful. And imagine if you were talking to a child that way. And there's been some postings on the forum about rearing children and childcare and having our instincts be kind of offline around how we care for other human beings. And it really starts with first, how do we care for ourselves and how can we be gentle with ourselves? How can we attend to the details and be really interested? So as I talk, talking lots, just continue to explore that chest and see if your breath, if in any way changes. And even bringing your hands below the chest, if you follow the sternum bone down to the ribs, just underneath those ribs, there's tissue. Often sometimes that tissue can be a little tender, especially if there's a tendency for us to be a little guarded, a little frozen. That area where the diaphragm is can get taut and tight. Gently tuning in there and being aware and oriented to yourself, but even as you do this, oriented to the surroundings around you. So every now and again, your eyes can be closed for this if they can be open, but use a little bit of both. good. And then let that be. So now just let your hands relax and just tune back into the area of the chest, that upper, lower part of the chest bone, sternum. So focusing on your inhale and your exhale. And if anything, slowing it down a little bit, if that's comfortable. So slowing down the breath, not trying to make it bigger or deeper, but just slowing down the breath. Slowing down the breath. And then we'll bring one more piece into this, go a little longer. So place one hand on the chest bone, so that area that you've just been kind of bringing your utmost care to, somewhere even lower, just even lower than the collarbone, so somewhere on the chest bone. Might be hard to get right in the middle, so just even a little bit above. So one palm, one hand there. And then bring the other one to your forehead, so that point in the skull above your eyebrows, where your good stuff sits, well, all good stuff in there, but where that frontal lobe, that the thinking and the creativity part of the brain sits, the cortex, what makes us human and creative beings. And just feel the connection between the chest, that middle, and the forehead. And the middle of the chest, I don't call it heart because it's not where our heart is, interestingly enough. Our heart is really more to the left. And this area, the technical area in therapy speak, at least in the speak that I use in the world of somatic experiencing and the touch work that I do and the more in-depth breathing work that I do. The area is called the big word, the mediastinum. It's a big word, the juicy word, the mediastinum. And it's underneath this chest, this chest bone is this beautiful big butterfly sheath that engulfs our heart and our lungs and goes to our spine and kind of bathes that whole area. And that is often the area that gets stuck and rigid when we have stress and held trauma in our bodies. And we want to gently tune into it and juice it up, let it know that it's safe. And then having your hand on your head, just sort of notice the connection of the hand on the chest, the hand on the forehead. And breathing, noticing the breath kind of connect the two of them. And you don't have to stay stone cold. You can move a little bit. You can even turn a little bit with this, feeling how those two can stay connected as you move a little bit. Up, down, right, left. As you do this, noticing your pelvis, your feet. Good. And then slowly kind of bring yourself back to this Q&A group call. And how was that for you? So if you're on your computer, just in the chat box, just type in one word or two. I'll give you two. One word or two words to describe your experience of that kind of 15-minute guided, we'll call it lesson, guided awareness lesson. Calming. Thanks, Glenda. A juicy softening. Ooh, I like that. Sensitive area, buzzing energy. Love it. Anything else? There's a few more of you here. Don't be shy. One word or two words. Soft and gentle. Thanks, Katie. Who else? Good. Meg and Sandina and Mauro, lovely connection. I got cut off. Well, you're obviously back, Mauro, so you can go back and listen to this. How's that sound? Tender. All right. Ah, missed it. Very important to be on time. So, but luckily I pressed record, so you'll be able to go back to that. So after the, once you get to the recording, you'll be able to go back to it and revisit this. So I'm going to start by answering the question that actually inspired this little audio. So this is a good reason, actually, so now that I'm thinking of it, to hand your questions in before the call, because it will inspire, in some ways, how I teach this first lesson. So as I'm going through this, whether you write something down to maybe think of a question that might pop up for you, and there might be, there might not be, but we'll see how we go. So this is from Jane, and Jane could not be on this call because she's in a training process right now, learning good information. So she writes, and it's Jane Courtney, for those of you who know her, you've seen her on the forum. What are some ways, her question is, what are some ways that I can continue to work on the frozen activation in my system, specifically around the chest area? I have a sense of grief and shock being trapped in my system as I continue my observation of my body and sensations, tightness in the chest, tears welling up easily, holding of breath. Are there some exercises that you sense would be of benefit for helping me delve deeper to support the opening? Now, that's a great question. And so the one piece is that, obviously, Jane, if you're listening to this, the lesson that you just would have done was my impulse answer to that is to find ways to bring your own attention and your own awareness to these areas that feel quite tight and that bring up emotion. So you said tears and grief, which are very important for us to experience and to experience them sensorially in the body while keeping ourselves connected and grounded in the body and resourced. So that's the first thing that I would say. The other piece, I'll go through this. She asks, what are some ways I continue to work on the frozen activation in my system? So first thing to know, working with freeze is one of the hardest and most challenging elements to work with. And I say that not to scare you and to make you go, oh my God, you know, I've got freeze in my system. How am I ever going to get out of this? Remember from when I was talking about my own personal story, I was in a very deep freeze when I started this work. It was functional, but I was definitely stuck in a bit of a frozen state. And it took time. So here's the first thing. It takes time. It's not something that we want to try to, it's not like putting the frozen chicken for dinner in the microwave and defrosting it. It can't happen in 20 minutes. Because actually, if you've ever defrosted something in a microwave, if you do it too quickly, what happens to it? It actually starts to get cooked, right? Has anybody had that happen before? It takes time. You've got to do it for a few minutes and then check it, turn it around, put it back in for another, you know, 0.2 pounds or something and hit start and you defrost a little bit more, you might need to move it a bit, change it, turn it on the other side. Hopefully someone else who's listening to this has defrosted meat in the microwave. The best way to defrost that chicken or steak is to actually leave it, if it's been in the freezer, on the countertop. And it takes time. It takes time, and it might take all day. If it's a turkey for Christmas, it might take 3 days to defrost that sucker. Yes, microwaves aren't the best. They are good for defrosting things. We don't have one, but melting butter, things like that. But that's besides the point. The point is when we've had a lifetime of held stresses. And we all have. We all have. We're not in this individually. We've got to remember all of us are in this together. And there can be a lot of grief in realizing how screwed up our system has become. And if you go into the forum and watch that video that Seth Dillinger posted on the continuum concept, Gene Liebloff, I highly recommend watching it. I highly recommend watching it when you really want to learn something, and be aware that it will maybe make you a bit sad. Laura, my assistant, watched it last night, and she posted on the forum. She was in tears. And it's not to scare any of you. It's not to scare us. It's just to really wake up. Like, this is the truth. This is what's going on in our culture. This is what has happened. And we really need to turn it around. So we need to defrost ourselves slowly. We need to defrost ourselves slowly. And that means taking time. So we look at how the course has been organized. It started with those basic elements of orienting, learning how to scan, learning how to track, learning to even know what self-awareness and awareness is, right? It's just a lot of it is theory at the beginning, and the theory is super important because it's complex, we're complex, the world is complex, and we need that knowledge. And then as we look at the course of the labs, the week before, lab two, we did more breath. We did more breathing work, right? We did a little more awareness work, bringing in the senses, more awareness. So again, sprinkling more awareness, more conscious exercising of the breath. But gently, being able to wake up a little bit more the areas. So, for your question, Jane, I would say, and this could be for all of you, if you think of the two breath lessons, the one cultivating the inhale, where there's a little more, it's a bit more Feldenkrais-based, where there's an opening and a filling of the chest and a sucking into the belly, and then there's a pushing out of the belly and the sinking of the chest. If you were to do that lesson, but like cut it by a hundredth, so not to cut it in half, but like a hundredth. So you do that and you make it really bloody small so that it's just the tiniest bit of a bigger inhale and a belly. Because again, it's like the microwave analogy. By the way, I've never used that analogy. That just came to me now. That analogy, again, if you put too much juice into the system, it can rebound. It'll get burned. So this is the trouble. And I'm not saying that all these modalities are bad, but a lot of breath work, a lot of deep breathing work, a lot of more cathartic breath work can be a bit problematic in a system that has held stress and trauma, which is the bulk of us, because it's not entering in slow enough and quiet enough. It needs to be experienced slowly. So that would be my one example, or my one suggestion, to try both of them even, but the inhale one more so, and to make it really small. All right. And then she asks in terms of tears welling up. So tears are interesting because, again, tears aren't bad. However, if tears become the default and we go to tears so quick, it's almost a reaction. And it's a reaction that can sometimes hide the underlying core feeling and sensation because something might be too overwhelming. That's one way of masking that is to just go right into crying. Again, some people never cry, and we want to get them to experience that emotion, so it really depends on the person. So if you're a person who cries at the drop of a pin, then we would want to slow down that process and often find out what precedes the tears. So again, if the trying is a default that happens really quickly, what precedes the tears? And from experience that I've had in working with Peter Levine and other mentors, often if we slow those tears down, anger is often in there, very deep, deep anger and rage. And then under that usually is an immense sadness. So the sadness is being expressed, but it's like we're bypassing the anger and the rage. So that would be one suggestion, to just sort of titrate and be slow around noticing what precedes the tears. Is it the tightness of the chest? And if it is the tightness in the chest, what even precedes that? So that's pretty much your question. I hope that answered it, Jane. And as I've mentioned to some of you, and I think I mentioned this last year, I'm gearing up to put together an extenuation of this course. Will be the Smart Body, Smart Mind School. It'll be 3 months, and that'll start in July, and it'll be kind of the next step from this. So for those of you that have gone through this material and want to continue and go deeper into ways of experiencing the different diaphragms of the body, different breath techniques, subtleties, working with deeper content, that might be the way to go. So I'm putting that together right now for you. So I've got Angela here and Sandina. So Sandina, importance of exhale and another practice for it. So I'm gonna attempt to unmute you, Sandina.
All attendees are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing *6.
Sandina, are you there? Are you able to talk into your computer microphone?
I'm not sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Hello.
Hiya.
So what's your question? Good to talk to you.
I was wondering, in my somatic bodywork training, working on somebody else, we can help them with the exhale by putting our hands on their chest and kind of pushing it out a bit. I was wondering if there's some practice I could do on myself for that. I've just always been conscious that my exhale, I feel like it should be more expanded. Or I would like to practice, see what happens, see what comes of my life with a more expanded exhale.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll keep you on the line and I'll just answer it. You're right. And one of the ways that I work with people one-on-one when there is touch work involved is working with the tissue around the chest, the ribs, the trapezius muscles, the neck, even the jaw, and working with the exhale while using sound. So deep sighs can be very good. So if you imagine like a breath in and then kind of a, hopefully that wasn't too loud for you, but almost like a real deep sigh. And sometimes vocalization is a really good way to do this for ourselves when we don't have somebody else's hands on our body. So to kind of imagine, even if you're sitting right now, to sort of on the inhale, raise your shoulders up towards your ears, like you're trying to make your shoulders your earrings. And then on the exhale, so you're really lifting and opening the chest. And on the exhale, kind of letting them drop and almost being very dramatic in how you sigh out. And that will free up the throat area, and then of course, because the sound is coming out of obviously your vocal cords and you need the breath, it sort of opens up the further, we call them diaphragms in the somatic experiencing work, in that it isn't just a diaphragm that we know of the diaphragm, but there's one in the throat, the chest, the belly. They kind of follow the chakras. And one thing, it's tough when sometimes a good set of hands and some very intelligent body work can really help actually unlock that. My favorite practices, other than of course the ones I do, are osteopathy. So if you can find a good osteopath or even a really intelligent massage therapist that can work with you on something that you want to work with, that might be one way to go. Does that help? Does that give you some ideas?
Yeah, thank you for the reminder, and it'll be a great thing for me to practice personally. Thank you.
Cool. Yeah, and as I mentioned when I answered Jane's question of taking the inhale and just making it much smaller, you can even go the other way and make it a little bigger. Granted, you know, you're connected and you stay oriented and within your own body and environment, and that can be another way to go the other way. So we can go both ways on those spectrums.
Thank you.
Cool. All right, so I'm going to mute you back. And Angela has a question. Would you say that some people are born having better stress regulating systems than others? Yes. I have always felt a little anxious from very little. All right, so that's a good question, and I'm actually going to provide you, I mentioned at the very beginning I'd be giving you another little training video on the vagus nerve and how it gets formed. And there's sort of two ways of looking at this. When we're born, we're not born in isolation. So we are born into the world after being in mom's uterus, in mom's belly. And everything that she experiences, we experience as well. And this is something we have to really realize. And, you know, I joke about this in an article I wrote a while ago, saying why it's okay to blame our parents for all of our troubles. And the sad matter, the fact is, it's true. We get our nurturing and our nature from them, and they get their nature and nurturing from their parents, and so on and so on. So this can become even a multi-generational discussion in terms of how have the genetics, the epigenetics of that family system developed. What kind of strife and struggle occurred? You know, was there struggle coming over on the ships from Europe, or were we the ones that were here and settled and, you know, in our roots? One of the best stories, actually, I'm going to circle around and then get to your specific question, is if you some of you know I've mentioned the author Gabor Maté, whom wrote quite a few books on the body and health. He even wrote the foreword to Peter Levine's book. I think it's in his book Scattered Minds, which I highly recommend you pick up, Angela. It's all about ADD, so attention deficit disorder, not only in children but in adults. And he talks about his life as a child, as a baby growing up in the ghettos of Hungary during the Second World War, and they were of Jewish religion, and you can imagine the amount of fear that he was brought into being born, and his mother worrying that he would be taken or she would be taken from him, and they were separated for quite some time. And he speaks quite openly and candidly about this, in that there is some element of management and work that he always is having to do, because he didn't have that good, secure attachment when he was born. It was the opposite of secure attachment, if anything. And when we don't have that secure attachment off the bat, our nervous system that calms us down, which is the ventral vagal portion of our parasympathetic. So if you go back to the first video on the biology of stress from the prerequisite videos, I talk about those different branches. That ventral vagal portion of the parasympathetic is not functioning when we are born into the world. And it grows and it develops and it sprouts based on our interactions with our parents. The better the attachment and the security in the first 3 years of life, the more capable we are of handling stressors as life goes on. It's why some people will have massive accidents and strife, and they just kind of bounce back. Everyone knows those people. Luckily, I'm very blessed. I am one of those people. I had really good attachment and security when I was young. I've had tons of accidents and injuries, and I tend to bounce back from them. If we haven't had that good attachment and security, it's a little harder for us to navigate some of life's stressors. It does not mean that we cannot learn and grow. This is the beauty of the nervous system. It's neuroplastic. It has what we call neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity, interestingly enough, it goes both ways, right? It isn't always in the positive realm. Neuroplasticity can also mean that we aren't able to deal with stress. That's how our body has formed its group pathways. But we want to be able to be up and give it that good connection. And again, this is what's happening in this course, is we're finding ways to engage with ourselves, become aware, and connect pieces of ourselves that we haven't really touched before, and become aware of how we go into events and situations. So the anxiety that you talk about that's always kind of in there, this is where it's interesting. If parents are alive, you know a little bit of your history, to almost do a little search into your history, into just get information. It's, again, not about pointing the finger, but getting information, finding out what did happen to my ancestors. You know, what did occur, and how did they cope, and how can I cope better? How can I? Parents, I'm interested in learning about this, not to blame you. I see Ashley's comment on this, but to become curious about we're all struggling in this. So how can we shift it? How can we change as a collective? Angela, does that answer the question that I've just answered for you? And I, for some reason, I can't unmute you. I apologize. Having great loving childhood, just for really no big event. I think I'm seeing what you're saying. Basically, we want to cultivate really good, pleasurable, fun childhoods that also have good discipline in them. A question that was brought up when I was watching and at this discussion I talked about. Mentioned to you, I was at a discussion with Deborah Mate a few weeks ago, and someone asked the question, what does it take to build healthy children? And he was like, curiosity, playfulness, good positive discipline, all these things. And then I added, and that the parents have to model that. They have to model curiosity and interest and emotional connection and all these things. That is where children learn it from. And then Ashley has a question here. How do we not blame our parents for this? Well, we can, but then we have to take responsibility into our own hands, right? Like, we can understand that that's where it came from, and we need to go through the period of being angry and a bit bitter, and then we have to get out of that. We have to be able to rise above the wounds and repair it. And if the family system isn't interested in repairing it with us, then we have to, in some ways, create a new family for ourselves and find who those new people are going to be who will accept a few of these. But the blame is surface. It's like the blame can be like an initial, that's where it comes from. It's like, okay, now I know where that comes from, and now what do I have to do, because this is my life. It's no longer theirs. And I have to get going and do good stuff on this planet for myself and for others. And the forgiveness piece is another interesting thing. It might not be that there's even a forgiveness that occurs, but an empathy. There's a great book by Bruce Perry in Maya. I can't remember her last name. called Born for Love, and it's all on empathy and the need to empathize. And we can empathize with our past families and our generational traumas. And one sentence that I've heard is used in Europe when some of my colleagues work with people who have been struck by Holocaust events, whether being the perpetrators or being the ones who have suffered, is it's quite powerful, but you ask your client, or I ask you, what would it have been like if your parents and your family had everything that they needed? So if they had everything that they needed, and their parents had everything that they needed, they had all the love and empathy and care, what would that be like? And it often can be difficult to even imagine that when there's been so much strife and turmoil. But how can you imagine? It's like an imagination, a fantasy. If everybody had everything that they needed, how would that be different for me now? Joyce says here, having compassion for our parents since they were reacting. Exactly. And this is what I've said. We have to look and have the compassion and the empathy. They didn't know what they were doing. Their parents didn't know what they were doing. It's just a string that we've created. And the key is, how can we change that path? It's everything is now forward. So how can everything be changed from now forward? And yes, we know that that's in the background, and then that was crappy, and they weren't there, and but they also weren't there because they were suffering in their own right. And then it's, how can we rise above that? Yes, Sandina, it's a very powerful question to ask. It often brings up, I remember when we were asked that in our training. Actually, one of my colleagues is here. Carol Lee's on the line. Hi, Carol Lee. And she was in that room, I think, when our instructor Steve said that. And I remember when he said that, tears just started to flow from my eyes completely. Because my mother is from the Philippines, some of you know this, and she grew up during martial law invasion of the Philippines by the Japanese. And her stories are pretty intense. And they had to survive based on this occupation of their country. And yet her capacity to move forward and through that, get an education, find her way to Canada, be kind to me, and it was incredible. And it almost brings tears to my eyes as I think about it right now, because she could have been a very bitter, hostile woman from what she witnessed and saw. And, you know, her mother died when she was 5 because the Japanese wouldn't allow penicillin into the Philippines. How awful is that? Right? So you could become very bitter at something like that, but you can't. And we know this. People have suffered horrible, horrible stuff, and yet they move on. So now, does anybody else have a question? If so, raise your hand, and I'm just scanning here. Raise your hand, going once, going twice. Or even if you have a comment on something that you'd like to share. And if not, I'll share one last story that I was going to share regarding breath, and then I'm also going to just review what's happening as we go into the third lab and then the fifth lab. Okay, so I'm going to share a little story. It has to do with breath, because this is a tricky piece, breath, so breathing, in that our breath can really shift and change based on circumstances. And some of you know the story, but last year, and I was primed to share because there's already pretty horrible wildfires going on down in Arizona, where I have actually KC, who you watched her video on week one. There's a lot of potential for danger right now for her and her family because there's fires that are rampant around the Sedona area. And my husband and I, Seth, were in some pretty bad smoke from wildfires last August in the Lake Tahoe region. And we woke up one morning and I could feel that something wasn't right. And we knew that there were fires because there was smoke, but it wasn't that bad when we went to sleep. But I woke up, and I'm lucky in that I don't get very often severe anxiety, if not ever. It's something that I haven't really had to deal with very much. I've been on the other side, being more frozen. But I woke up and something was wrong. Like, it was wrong, and I could sense my heart was beating. It was constricting. I couldn't breathe. And we woke up and we looked outside and we could hardly see across to the trees. The smoke was so thick. And we tried to go into another room that had more sealed windows and put blankets under the door frame so the smoke wouldn't get in, but it still got in. So I said to my husband, we've got to leave now, because I could not take a full breath in. This was like true biological anxiety. It was like my brain saying, you are not getting enough. There's pollutants in the air you're breathing, and we're going to shut your system down. So we left quickly at 4 in the morning, and we drove to San Francisco pretty fast. And I remember getting to Davis, which is a university town, and being able to breathe. However, I had trouble breathing for a little while, and actually ended up having to work with my colleagues on the fright and the fear, essentially suffocating to the extreme, but that is what the brain goes into. You're going to suffocate if you don't get enough air and oxygen. And so we had to work with that. We worked one-on-one. Because I had the fortune of being in his office, we were able to do some stuff where he had his hands on various parts of my diaphragm. And we were able to change that and to move it. And I say this because I was, in my own attempts, trying to move this stuckness in my diaphragm after this fire smoke experience, but I actually needed that witness. I needed that person to sit with me and to be empathetic to the scare that my biology had. It wasn't my brain, right? It was my biology felt a true biological anxiety occur. And then I could move through that. I could realize I'm not in that fire anymore. And I'm a smart girl. I knew that I was not in that fire anymore, but there was this underlying brainstem, nervous system piece of me that knew that something still wasn't right. So sometimes I say this because breath exercises can sometimes hit a chord with a lot of people. And if you're finding that there's still a continual struggle to get your breathing in, it might be that a little bit of help and support in a one-on-one aspect with a practitioner who's skilled in the somatic work, somatic experiencing, whether it's myself or one of my colleagues, can help you move through that. So I just wanted to say that. A little fire story. Okay, Luana, I'm going to try to unmute you, but it says here that there's something on your computer that hasn't been allowed, so it's not allowing me to unmute you. So could you write your question into the chat box, my dear? Oh, you just changed something. Okay, talk. Can I hear you? Hello? Hi.
So I have a question about, I guess it could be related to secure attachment. I have been having some troubles with a friendship recently, and I wanted to get your recommendation on how I can allow the other person to become more curious about mending the relationship without me taking the first step, I guess.
Well, I guess the first question would be, is do you want the friendship to continue, which you do not have to answer right now, so you can just pose that question to yourself. And then it's pretty hard for someone to read our minds, so it's kind of like, how can there be a discussion that is not driven by blame or reactivity, but an openness? And this can be tricky. This can be actually really tricky if the other party is primed to take in information from another as always being threatening to them or blaming. So you yourself have to be very solid in expressing how things are for you. So in other words, this is what I'm experiencing in myself, and if the person is someone that you really want to continue to be in interaction with, you say that. You say, I actually really love you for these reasons. I like hanging out with you for these reasons, and I'm afraid that if I don't talk to you about this, that it's going to end. And so I'm gonna just pause there. And as I say those things, what are you experiencing? Those words that I give you.
In my jaw, I feel tightness.
Mhm.
And from past experiences in this relationship, I'm just going back and looking at it, like this pattern has happened before, and
mm-hmm.
Repair itself in the ideal way that makes me feel expansive and good. So I guess I have to think about the depth of the relationship and how I want the depth to continue.
Good. And so here's another piece, is not every repair is going to feel expansive and good. I know that might seem a bit weird, but if I think about my own relationships, I'll use my husband as the best example. And I know he's okay with me talking about this, but there are certain times where there's something that really pisses me off that he's doing, and we're in a good, healthy relationship. That's one thing. But it will not feel good to me to bring up these things with him. I will actually feel downright frightened of essentially him cutting off from me. And my biggest fear of that is abandonment, like that he will leave if I tell him how it really is. That is not a sense of expansiveness. It is a sense of almost, not shame, but like waiting for the hit to come. And it's a risk. I actually say it's a risk. And when we haven't had healthy attachment where we can risk and put out some kind of juice and you know, fire to our primary caregivers and be accepted for that, it hinders our capacity to do that with people in the future. So what I'm trying to say is sometimes repairing a relationship doesn't feel very good. And it actually feels downright uncomfortable and kind of scary. And it you have to pose the question to yourself, do I actually want to experiment with this and be able to sit in the uncomfortableness that this person might freak out, or that this person might actually, and this is, I'll give you my own personal example because that's all I can really provide, is more often than not, when we're really vulnerable and truthful and we put it out as it is, if that person is meant to be in our life, they'll actually match us with equal care and they might feel uncomfortable, but if they're willing to repair the relationship and move forward, something usually good will come out of it, and then the expansiveness occurs. But it takes that first, that little bit of a risk to just risk the how you feel, how the tightness in the jaw is, and know that it will be worth it in the end, meaning it might end, or it might grow and it might flourish. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. But yeah, I know what you're saying about you want everything to be done with expansiveness and love, and love is definitely there, but there also is that, the way I feel it in my body, it's like there's a vibration in the cells that isn't really a deep openness and flowing, but if there's a movement in the cells, but it's a vibration that's kind of like, I don't know if I want to say this, but I think I have to, because if I don't, my jaw's going to stay tight forever. Right?
Yeah, at this point, I'm kind of feeling that, because on the other end, I'm sensing a little bit of avoidance, and over the last few days, it's been in my body kind of stewing, and I'm trying to put it out there to mend to the best way possible, but it's still in my body.
So. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, here's the other honest truth, my dear, is that, and I know I've mentioned this before, maybe in this group, I have a really good relationship with my husband. Some of you know him, and we still go and see one of my colleagues for what would be called couples counseling. I don't call it that. But we have, you know, a session booked every month, and we go whether or not we're in a good state with each other or not in a good state. And it isn't to point fingers or to try to fix anything. It's just to learn how to better communicate with somebody else. When we know that that person is someone that we want to be with for a long time. And I would actually say that, you know, it would be great for any of you on this line that have partners or really close relationships with people that you want to continue with, to seek out some kind of intelligent somatic therapeutic support, where there is a very intelligent way of learning how to communicate that isn't about blame, that is about being in your own personal space and having the other person really see you for that in all your vulnerability. And a lot can heal and a lot can change, not just in the relationship, not just in the co-regulation of the relationship, but in your own self-regulation. Because a lot of that secure connection, if we go back to that question about blaming our parents, if we didn't get that kind of interaction originally, we will go into relationships continually trying to get it. And sometimes we need that other nervous system, which is the therapist, which is the pastor, the priest, the counselor, whatever, to help us repair. It's really sometimes, it is tough to sometimes do this just on our own. So I hope that helps you, sweetie.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. I'm going to put you back to mute, okay? Okay. Let me just see the chat box here. So Anne from the U.S., so healthy attachment at the beginning of life is the resourcing. Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, Anne. It is. That's definitely the resourcing. And it's what paves our way. And like I said, it doesn't mean that things cannot be shifted and repaired, but it requires a little bit more work. It requires a little bit more help. And as I just mentioned, when we didn't have that at the beginning, and you have, if you have two people that aren't sure how to play this game of attachment and interaction and healthy aggression and anger and speaking up, we sometimes do need that other party to put the mirror in front of both of our faces and say, this is what's going on. And Ashley, making me cry. I hope those are good tears. Yeah, a lot more work. Yeah, this is definitely, this work is not for those that want to stay quiet and inside and disengaged from the world. It's for those who want to really learn how to master this art of human interaction, because that's kind of what it is. As we finish up today, we're human beings that work in regulation with other people. And if our regulation was disturbed and disrupted when we were young or at any point in our life, it really all comes back to learning how to reconnect with ourselves and with others. A lot of us are great at regulating and being on our own, but the real work comes when we start to add in that element of the other people. And how can you be regulated in your stress response while being with another person who might not know how to regulate their stress response? And that's the tricky part. I'll leave you with one book recommendation, actually. I need to get a reading list, I think, on my website. But a wonderful book for any of you who are in intimate relationships is called Passionate Marriage. And the author, I can't remember his last name. It starts with an S. I think it's Robert S. something. But it's Passionate Marriage, and I'll write it in the chat box here. Lovely book, to the point that I read it actually when I wasn't in relationship. I was in between relationships, and it's a great book to read. Meg, yes, sometimes I do mind read. All right, everybody. Hopefully this hour has been useful. We've got two more weeks to go. Next week, so Lab 3, there's a lot of content. There are 5 things for you to do. There are 4 lessons, audio lessons, and there's 1 video. Therefore, definitely make a plan. Tell yourself right out when you're going to do the lessons. Book them in your scheduler. Make it be the most important thing you do that day, so that you keep up to speed. And I am going to be traveling for the next week, so our next call is not until Monday the 9th, and it's going to be a slightly different time in the afternoon. And as we wrap up this course, we're definitely going to be looking for feedback from you about how to make this course better and more accessible. So start to think about those things, things that you love, things that you didn't love so much, so that we can keep improving this so that more people can come and experience this information. So I will be signing off. Take care, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. And we will talk to you in a few weeks and see you on the Facebook forum. Please get over there if you haven't already and even just say hello. Have a wonderful Saturday. Bye, everybody.